The distance between James Madison's home at Montpelier in Virginia and New York City, where he was sitting as part of the Virginia delegation to the Confederation Congress, consumes about 5 hours of travel time today. But in 1787, the 330 miles which lie between those two points would require a week, over roads that John Bernard, an English actor visiting America, described as sad comparison with the bowling greens of England. "Very often," wrote Bernard, "we surprised a family of pigs taking a bath in a gully of sufficient compass to admit the coach. As often, such chasms were filled with piles of stones that at a distance looked like the Indian tumuli. The driver's skill in steering was eminent. I found there were two evils to be dreaded in traveling: a clayey soil in wet weather, which, unqualified with gravel, made the road a canal, and a sandy one in summer, which might emphatically be called an enormous insect preserve." Of course, strictly speaking, Montpelier was not James Madison's home. It belonged to his father, James Madison Sr. At age 36, James Madison was, in effect, still living as a dependent. This gave him the freedom to engage in politics and to begin sketching out his ideas for the convention to meet in Philadelphia before taking leave of Montpelier. But as a bachelor in his 30s, Madison was an odd man out among the delegates who would be attending the Philadelphia convention. A friend who had moved over the mountains to the western Virginia province of Kentucky teased Madison by reminding him of the taunts to which old bachelors are justly exposed and from which the best services to the public in other respects will not screen you much longer. "But I shall not say more, as I have had an intimation that you are like to be in a more honorable state ere long." Well, in fact, Madison would not marry until 1794, and then to a widow named Dolly Payne Todd. And he would have no natural children of his own, although the behavior of Dolly's son by her first marriage would provide him with all the anxiety he might have anticipated under other circumstances. And it is worth wondering whether those best services to the public might have occurred in quite the way they did if Madison had been more domestically preoccupied. It is curious that the most important figures in moving the Republic out from under the shadow of the Articles of Confederation were men with surprisingly tenuous connections to family and place. George Washington had married a widow, Martha Dandridge Custis, who brought her own two children, Patsy and Jackie, to the marriage, but who produced no others after marrying Washington. Patsy, who was subject to epileptic seizures, died in the summer of 1773 at age 17. Her brother, Jackie, was a spoiled brat who rushed from youthful infatuation to an early marriage, then rushed to join the Continental Army and died of a camp fever shortly after the British surrender at Yorktown. He left four children, two of whom the Washingtons would raise themselves at Mount Vernon, Nellie and George Washington Park Custis. The latter, incidentally, would become the father-in-law of Robert E. Lee. But this meant, in effect, that George Washington also had little in the way of family, something for which he compensated by creating a military family of his own around young Alexander Hamilton, the Marquis de Lafayette, John Laurens, John Marshall, and James Monroe. Men like Madison and Washington came out of the Revolution unencumbered by vast family responsibilities, and so they were at liberty to think in broad national terms. Men like Patrick Henry and George Mason, on the other hand, who had substantial families to care for and futures to promote, would turn out to be far more concerned with safeguarding their region or state or locality. So, as Patrick Henry's son-in-law, Spencer Roane, enviously observed, "Madison, born to affluence and a competent fortune, and unencumbered with the cares of a family, was free to do a substantial amount of homework before leaving for Philadelphia. It is as though, at almost the last minute, the Confederation Congress realized how long things had been let slide, and how needy the Articles of Confederation were for amendment, or worse. In the spring of 1786, Charles Pinckney of South Carolina had upbraided the Confederation Congress about the need to put its house in order. Only, as William Grayson reported to Madison, to run hard into the refusal of New York and Pennsylvania to become part of a genuine national compact. While at the same time, Delaware, Rhode Island, Jersey, and some others would balk at having their vote with respect to any new powers granted to Congress take place according to their real and not their supposed importance in the Union. Remember that under the Articles of Confederation, each state received equal representation in the Confederation Congress, and that equal representation amounted to just one vote per state. That meant that small states like Delaware, New Jersey, states which were small not only in size but in population, nevertheless had equal voice in the Confederation Congress with large states like Virginia and Pennsylvania. And those small states were not eager to see that kind of equal say, that kind of leverage, taken away in any kind of change made in the Articles of Confederation. In August of 1786, a grand committee that included Pinckney proposed a series of amendments to the Articles of Confederation that would add 7 new articles and amend the others to give Congress the sole power of regulating the trade of the states as well as foreign nations with each other, and of laying such prohibitions and imposts and duties as may be necessary for the purpose, and to levy a 10% fine on states that failed to submit their financial quotas. But this was all too little, too late, especially after the eruption of Shays' Rebellion that fall. The Congress had greeted Shays' Rebellion with paralyzed indecision. Instead, on February 21, 1787, the Confederation Congress meekly approved the proposal of the Annapolis Convention for a convention of representatives for the purpose of revising the Articles of Confederation and Perpetual Union to render the federal Constitution adequate to the exigencies of the government and the preservation of the Union. James Madison, meanwhile, had already embarked on his own private study of ancient and modern confederacies, surveying the ancient classical confederations, the Swiss Helvetic Confederacy of 1308, the Belgic Confederacy of 1679, the old Imperial German Confederation. While trolling through Montesquieu, Polybius, Plutarch's Lives, Sir Walter Raleigh's History of the World, and histories of Germany, Switzerland, and the Low Countries. Alongside this compendium of examples, Madison then composed a summary of what he called the vices of the political system of the United States, from which he would survey the failures of the Articles of Confederation in a fashion so unsparing that any thought of mere amendment would be worthless. Madison listed 11 such vices, and we'll go down the list of all of them because all of them have something important to say. First, failure of the states to comply with the constitutional requisitions. In other words, what Madison was saying was that under the Articles of Confederation, the states had refused to pay their portion of the federal budget, something which, from Madison's review of similar forms of government, was so inherent from the number and independent authority of the states, and has been so uniformly exemplified in every similar confederacy, that it may be considered as not less radically and permanently inherent in then it is fatal to the object of the present system. Second, encroachments by the states on the federal authority, which Madison saw particularly in the troops raised and to be kept up by Massachusetts during Shays' rebellion. If every state hired its own mercenary force, as Governor Bowdoin had been compelled to do, how long would it be before these forces were used by the states against each other? Third, violations of the law of nations and of treaties. Madison had seen how individual states, including his own Virginia, interpreted the Treaty of Peace with Great Britain, as well as other treaties, to suit themselves, either by refusing to return confiscated Loyalist property or to satisfy pre-war debts to British subjects. This was already inducing the British to refuse to hand over the western frontier posts they were pledged to evacuate under the 1783 treaty that ended the Revolution. And it was an attitude which was going to pay evil dividends in trying to persuade the Spanish to open navigation rights on the Mississippi to American commerce. Fourth in the list of vices, trespasses of the states on the rights of each other. And here, Madison had dead in his aim the beggar my neighbor attitude created by the floods of state paper money. Paper money, installments of debts, occlusion of courts, making property a legal tender may likewise be deemed aggressions on the rights of other states. And it required the creation of a federal authority worthy of the name to restrain this. Vice number five, want of concert in matters where common interest requires it. There were institutions and responsibilities which any nation requires and every nation has to undertake. But these responsibilities and institutions the states had effectively blocked by their almighty vetoes in the Confederation Congress. What nation, Madison asked, what nation really lacked uniformity in the laws concerning naturalization and literary property, of provision for national seminaries, for grants of incorporation for national purposes, for canals and other works of general utility? Answer, the United States of America, under the Articles of Confederation, where every single one of these benefits may at present be defeated by the perverseness of particular states whose concurrence is necessary. Sixth vice, want of guarantee to the states of their constitutions and laws against internal violence. Now, here, for the first time, Madison moved away from the practical to the theoretical. In a republic, he reasoned, right and power, being both vested in the majority, are held to be synonymous. The problem is that moments occur, for instance, in an appeal to force, where the minority proves to be an overmatch for the majority and thus reverses the polarities of popular government. Power trumps liberty because power in this circumstance is armed. If the minority happened to include all such as possess the skill and habits of military life, Madison continued, and such as possess the great pecuniary resources, one-third only may conquer the remaining two-thirds. But sometimes it wasn't weapons or resources which overturned a republic's majority. One-third of those who participate in the choice of the rulers may be rendered a majority if they can arouse enough of the mob to vote for them. The mob being those whose poverty excludes them from a right of suffrage and who, for obvious reasons, will be more likely to join the standard of sedition than that of the established government. Customary as it was to regard the chief threat to a republic as coming from power, imposed from the top down by a conqueror, Madison had seen enough in Pennsylvania, Rhode Island, and western Massachusetts to know that a few unscrupulous demagogues can whip up the body politic, seize power, and make themselves fully as dictatorial a tyranny as any kings, while all the same pleading liberty. Madison's seventh vice flowed directly out of the sixth. Want of sanction to the laws and of coercion in the government of the Confederacy. Should some band of lowlifes succeed in putting one of their own at the head of a state, was the national government merely to stand by helpless and shrug its shoulders until one by one the states were converted in similar fashion into nasty little despotisms? The Articles of Confederation are, in fact, nothing more than a treaty of amity, of commerce, and of alliance between independent and sovereign states, which was a pleasant enough idea, so long as Americans believed that the justice, the good faith, the honor, the sound policy of the several legislative assemblies would render superfluous any appeal to the ordinary motives by which the laws secure the obedience of individuals. But time and experience had shown that it is no longer doubted that a unanimous and punctual obedience of 13 independent bodies as to the acts of the federal government ought not to be calculated on. Suppose for a moment the laws of the states were merely recommendatory to their citizens. Or if they were to be rejudged by county authorities, what security, what probability would exist that they would be carried into execution? The answer, of course, was not much. So, why do we now expect the states will behave in any other way in relation to the federal authority? The national government had the responsibility to ensure that the nation remained a republic, not only as a nation, but in its component parts, too. Never, it's safe to say, had anyone expressed so much contempt for the misbehavior of the states than Madison in these two vices. But he goes on. Vice number 8. Want of ratification by the people of the Articles of Confederation. Madison had noticed that recognition of the Confederation's authority had never been incorporated into several of the state constitutions and has received no other sanction than that of the legislative authority. Whenever a law of a state happens to be repugnant to an act of Congress, particularly when the latter is of posterior date to the former, it will be questionable whether the latter must not prevail. Ninth vice, multiplicity of laws in the several states. Under the Articles, there was no review of state laws by the national government to ensure that the state laws did not contradict each other, that what was deemed a crime in one state was not contradicted by a statute in another state, or that fugitives from justice in one state could not find refuge and immunity in another. Try the codes of the several states by this test, Madison suggested, and what a luxuriancy of legislation do they present. Every year, almost every session, adds a new volume. No one can expect them all to harmonize. But what is the recourse when they don't? And wouldn't it be simpler if a federal criminal and civil code existed, which made all the luxuriancy of the state codes superfluous? Vice number 10, mutability of the laws of the states. Not only do the state laws overlap and contradict, they are constantly being repealed or superseded before any trial can have been made of their merits, and even before a knowledge of them can have reached the remoter districts within which they were to operate. That, Madison hinted, was particularly fatal to commerce, since in the regulations of trade, this instability becomes a snare, not only to our citizens, but to foreigners also. Finally, in the 11th vice, Madison unleashed his most personal arrow. For not only were the state laws as changeable as the weather, their very instability suggests something ominous about republican government itself. A defect, he said, still more alarming, not merely because it is a greater evil in itself, but because it brings more into question the fundamental principle of republican government, that the majority who rule in such governments are the safest guardians, both of public good and of private rights. Madison wrote, in terms as stinging as they were accurate, that individuals of extended views and of national pride may bring the public proceedings to this standard, but the example will never be followed by the multitude. Is it to be imagined that an ordinary citizen, or even assemblyman of Rhode Island, in estimating the policy of paper money, ever considered or cared in what light the measure would be viewed in France, or Holland, or even in Massachusetts or Connecticut? It was a sufficient temptation to both that it was for their interest. It was a sufficient sanction to the latter that it was popular in the state, to the former that it was so in the neighborhood. The state legislatures, Madison said, are, to be blunt, filled with greedy, small-minded, provincial types who are incapable of rising above the narrow horizons of self-interest, an attitude not only fatal to the Articles, but a contradiction of the self-denial and civic virtue which was supposed to suffuse a republic, and one which made the world wonder, as Washington had feared, that a republic might be beyond the capacity of ordinary people. And maybe, Madison had to consider, that was true. Or at least that a republic so large and scattered that it took a week to travel to its political center was simply too spread out ever to be well governed by any means, much less a republic. Even Montesquieu had warned that it is natural for a republic to have only a small territory, because in an extensive republic, there are men of large fortunes, too considerable to be placed in any single subject, and sooner or later the man of large fortunes begins to think that he may be happy and glorious by oppressing his fellow citizens, and that he may raise himself to grandeur on the ruins of his country. But Madison was also aware that David Hume had offered a counterpoise to this in his Idea of a Perfect Commonwealth in 1752. True, Hume wrote, a small commonwealth is the happiest government in the world within itself, but this was because everything lies under the eye of the rulers. Hence, small communities could as easily become the seedbeds of despotism as empires. By the same token, Hume saw no reason why a large state such as France or Great Britain, couldn't be modeled into a commonwealth, because the larger the territory, the more factions are likely to spring up, and the more factions, the less likely that any one of them will be able to amount to much of a threat to the others. In a large government, which is modeled with masterly skill, the parts are so distant and remote that it is very difficult, either by intrigue, prejudice, or passion, to hurry them into any measures against the public interest. In the open air of a large company of people and territory, faction dissipates and leaves the people free. That possibility offered the key for Madison. And in mid-April 1787, Madison made bold to lay his ideas for an entirely new frame of government before the one man who, more than any other, could make it happen: George Washington. The old general had been glad to find that Congress had recommended to the states to appear in the convention proposed to be holden in Philadelphia in May. And he told Madison that a thorough reform of the present system is indispensable. That was enough of an opening for Madison. Having been lately led to revolve the subject, which is to undergo the discussion of the convention, and formed in my mind some outlines of a new system, I take the liberty of submitting them, without apology, to your eyes. First, wrote Madison, there is no need to believe that the individual independence of the states is utterly irreconcilable with their aggregate sovereignty. The solution was not to abolish the states and suck them into a consolidation of the whole as one simple republic. That would be as inexpedient as it is unattainable. What Madison had in mind was some middle ground, which may at once support a due supremacy of the national authority, yet not exclude the local authorities wherever they can be subordinately useful. The way to this, Madison recommended, was through a change in the principle of representation in Congress. Don't let the state legislatures send single-vote delegations anymore. Have representatives in Congress elected directly by the people of the states in proportion to each state's population. I am ready to believe that such a change would not be attended with much difficulty, Madison assured Washington. The Congress would then become the representatives of the people at large, not the states. And the lesser states, and Rhode Island must surely have been on his mind in saying this, must in every event yield to the predominant will. On the other hand, Madison wanted none of the unicameral Pennsylvania nonsense when it came to the structure of Congress. The legislative department might be divided into two branches, one of them chosen every year by the people at large or by the legislatures, the other to consist of fewer members to hold their places for a longer term and to go out in such a rotation as always to leave in office a large majority of old members. Next, Madison proceeded, give the national government positive and complete authority in all cases which require uniformity, such as the regulation of trade, including the right of taxing both exports and imports, the fixing the terms and forms of naturalization, etc., etc. And in order to prevent the states from passing the multitude of laws they would pass to obstruct this complete authority, give Congress over and above this positive power, a negative, a veto, in all cases whatsoever on the legislative acts of the states. Without a national veto over state legislation, every positive power that can be given on paper will be evaded and defeated. And the states, Madison said, will continue to invade the national jurisdiction, to violate treaties and the law of nations, and to harass each other with rival and spiteful measures dictated by mistaken views of interest. And not only should Congress have a veto over state legislation, the national supremacy ought also to be extended, as I conceive, to the judiciary departments. Finally, he added, a national executive must also be provided, not just a chairman or president of Congress, although he was prudent enough to assure Washington that he had scarcely ventured as yet to form my own opinion, either of the manner in which it ought to be constituted or of the authorities with which it ought to be clothed. And Madison was vague about that because he was already imagining no one more fit for such a national executive office than Washington himself. Washington took careful notes on Madison's letter and filed them away with correspondence he had been conducting with John Jay and Henry Knox on the same subject. But would he do anything about it? Madison had made sure that Washington's name, along with his own, appeared on the list of Virginia's delegates to Philadelphia. But Washington was feeling his years that winter. Fever and rheumatism had landed him in bed for 2 weeks. Two of his old revolutionary compatriots, Jonathan Trumbull of Connecticut and General Nathaniel Greene, died. The affairs of the Potomac Company were moving at glacial speed. Even though Shays' rebellion that fall had quickened his fury and frustration, he was not exaggerating when he told Henry Knox that he was finished with public life and wanted only to be gliding down the stream of life in tranquil retirement. There was also a sticking point about schedule. Washington had only just declined an invitation from the Society of the Cincinnati, the veterans organization founded by his old officers, to attend their annual meeting in the same month of May in Philadelphia. If he declined their invitation, but then showed up in Philadelphia anyway, was he not doing an embarrassing injustice to his old officers? A point that we might try to explain away as smoothly as possible was not going to be nearly so easy for a man like Washington, who was not the sort to take the smooth way around embarrassments. Happily for Madison, he was not going to have to make the immense journey to Philadelphia all the way from Montpelier. From where he was sitting in the Confederation Congress in New York, he was able to be in Philadelphia on May 3rd, 11 days before the convention was due to open. But there was no Washington. In fact, there wasn't much of anyone, apart from the Pennsylvania delegation, which included the tottering old Benjamin Franklin, the embattled James Wilson, Thomas Mifflin, and Robert Morris. As opening day arrived, Madison, as he complained in a letter to Thomas Jefferson, was disheartened that the number as yet assembled is but small. But he despaired too quickly. On Sunday, May 13th, the chiming of bells, the noise of crowds thronging the streets, and the clatter of the first city troop of cavalry announced the arrival of Washington. The first man of the Republic had come to bless the convention with his participation.